Rokan Show right here. Moment of silence. The Rokan Show on 720 WGN. Mr. Richard Roper is in the studio. Richard Roper reviewing the films. But we should mention that yesterday we played an interview that you did with Harrison Ford. That Harrison Ford that you did exclusively for us here.
Yes.
And you know what? I think we learned a lot from him. As he's in this new movie, it's a remake of a Jack London novel, right?
The Call of the Wild.
And he is he has very specific thoughts about, you know, the kind of movies that he's doing now, right? I mean, we learned that he's got the most amazing career. I think. What did you say it's iconic in the sense that he's probably in a 1-2 punch by being both Indiana Jones and Han Solo. Maybe.
Yeah, I think if you look at just in terms of not only box office, although I think even box office wise, but also just effect on the pop culture landscape and in film in specific, there's no 1-2 combination in modern history, maybe ever, as those two roles in terms of iconic roles. I put Rocky and Rambo a distant second at this point. And whatever Emma Watson does, along with Hermione from Harry Potter, is right there.
Oh, wait,
love her. No, but I mean, it really is when you think about it. When you think about the billions of dollars those films have made, and the impact that character, you know, Indiana Jones, obviously, and he's going to do a fifth and final Indiana Jones. They're going to start filming this summer.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
I mean, he looks like Sean Connery now in the Indiana Jones. The Sean Connery.
Well, he's going to be. There already have been iterations.
Are they hanging over?
There's going to be a little, you know, some baton passing. But he's playing Indiana Jones.
Elijah Craig. I'm sorry, that's a bourbon. Elijah, what's the guy's name?
Shia LaBeouf was in one of the Indiana Jones. I don't know. They haven't talked specifically about what they're going to do on the timeline with this one. But he has said they are going to start filming in a couple of months.
Indiana Jones himself said this about why it's important for him to make family films.
Yeah, I'm always looking for something different to what I've lately done. And I've always had an interest in family films. They've been really important to my career because they're passed on from generation to generation. I'm introduced to new generations. I don't know that I need another introduction to another generation at this point in my life. They might outlast me, but they will outlast me. But, you know, that's been of great benefit. So I enjoy making family films.
That's interesting. And I know you hear from younger actors who like making animated films or kids films so their kids can see them. But I think that's a very nice thing because it must be something very special to be in an iconic film that is passed down generationally, as he pointed out. Even if it's something, you know, like Indiana Jones, which is, you know, not for the littlest of kids, but it is, you know, it's not a cartoon, right?
No, it's for the same kind of the beginning audience for Indiana Jones and for the Star Wars film. Really, when you start to be, you know, 10, 12 years old,
right,
I think is when you really get into those movies.
All right, well, let's talk about this film.
The Call of the Wild. So as Ro mentioned, it's based on this Jack London 1903 short novel that is still to this day one of the most legendary stories. And it's all about survival in the Yukon in the 1890s. But it was essentially the hero of the story has always been Buck the dog, a sled dog who lived in comfort at a judge's home in California, then gets kidnapped and sold as a sled dog, lead sled dog, and as the story progresses, actually starts to hear the call of the wild and really becomes more wolf-like and you know, more free in some ways. They've made movies. They made a silent movie of it. Clark Gable did a movie. Charlton Heston, Rutger Hauer, they've done it, you know, every 20 years or so. There's way more Calls of the Wild than Stars Are Born in the grand scheme of things. No one's ever starred in both, though. We've never had Bradley Cooper Call of the Wild, although we might one day.
I think I saw three of them, so I didn't have to read the book in high school.
So in this version, and they've changed the story over the years and adapted it. You know, certain elements from the 1890s don't play as well in current modern day lore. If you get the in the original book, the Indian tribe murdering everybody, and they kind of take all of that out. But it's still true to the essential story, which is about this sled dog who does get kidnapped from a California home and becomes a sled dog. And the Harrison Ford character, who used to be in the book, was a crusty old prospector, is now actually a man who is mourning his son who died and couldn't cope with his marriage and left his marriage and is a loner, and now has teamed up with Buck, this crazy big giant sled dog who's become kind of a sidekick to him. So in this clip right here, he's actually talking about going on one last adventure.
Come here. This is a map of the Yukon. My son was always reading adventure stories. He's crazy about the news coming out of the Yukon. It wasn't the gold. He didn't care about that. It was the mountains. He spent all day looking at maps and pictures of the mountains, dreaming about what was on the other side. Places no one had been. Wild places. We could go. You and me. See what's out there. What do you think?
Do we think that the dog... Does the dog read?
Well, of course the dog understands maps and everything. As you'll notice there, though, astute listeners such as yourself, Rokan, will note that all the dialogue is Harrison's because it's a dog.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I reluctantly have to deliver the news here that
but don't do it yet.
Giving a review right after we hear from Lauren, in which I will tell you exactly why there are certain things I liked and certain things I didn't.
Okay, we'll find out.
Remembering Fashion Fair, a look back at a trailblazing Chicago-based beauty brand with plans for a dramatic comeback. That's tonight on WGN TV News at 9, Row. Don't miss it.
Richard Roper, I think that was your beauty brand, wasn't it?
Might be. We don't want to give that away, but people should definitely tune in for the full story.
All right, so we're talking about the new Harrison Ford movie that is coming out here, Call of the Wild. It's based on the Jack London novel and made a number of times in Hollywood. The dog is a CGI dog, right? It's not a real dog.
It's actually a combination of CGI and the motion capture, which I think people are now familiar with, where a lot of times an actor will, like for the Planet of the Apes movies, or we mentioned, you know, Lord of the Rings, where you have your Gollum, there's a human actor. Often Andy Serkis is like the most famous in the world. And then they kind of, you know, shade it all in. So in this case, they actually had like a Cirque du Soleil dude playing the dog so that Harrison Ford had someone to play off of. If you have a chance to see the footage, if you'd like Google it, they should not have released any of the footage because you see a man pretending to be a dog and Harrison Ford petting it and taking bones out of its mouth. But it's a CGI creation. And that's unfortunately the reason I can't recommend the movie and I'm giving it 2 stars is because I understand why they wanted to use the CGI creation because it'd be very difficult, though they've done it in the past with a real dog playing this giant 140-pound sled dog. But the animation or the CGI is very similar to what you saw in last year's movie The Lion King or recently in Doolittle. But those were movies in which the animals talked.
Yeah.
They were animated to that level.
They had to do that.
So here... And it's not just Buck the dog. It's all the sled dogs and even the wolves they encounter are all CGI creations. So it feels as if they're in this CGI animated universe, whereas Harrison Ford and the human characters are in a real universe. It's not a fantastical story. It's grounded in the reality of 1890s Yukon. So it never quite sits right when he looks at the dog. And, you know, the great dog movies through the years that make you cry, it's real dogs. Like, my dog, Skip. Did you ever see my dog, Skip? I'll tell you every time.
You want to make me cry right now? What are you doing?
Yeah.
Does the film otherwise look...
It's a great-looking film, and almost all of it was shot in California or on sound stages, and it looks like they're in the Yukon a lot. I mean, the actual mountains and streams, all of that is all computer-generated as well. That you believe. It's when you get in even the scenes when you see the dog sled from a distance rolling through the mountains and all the dogs yapping and sliding and all that. It's when you get to the close-ups of the dog's faces, in particular the lead sled dog, and you just go, that's not a real dog. As expressive as dogs are, this dog is like Robin Williams, you know, in his prime during a, you know, comic relief event. You're like, wow! Those are a lot of expressions from a dog.
Fossy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Where is the star level here then?
Two stars. Yeah. I think it's going to do pretty
little
well.
Little kids like it? Or is it
I
too
think
scary
so.
For them?
Little kids, it'll go over their heads. But no, I think most kids will like it. I think it'll do pretty well because there's always a demand for a family film.
Yeah. Yeah, hope well for him, but what you're saying is it just doesn't lay across the eye, right?
Not at all. I found it, you know, 5 minutes in, I thought, well, this is going to be really, really well made. Probably not going to get past it. Maybe other folks will. Maybe I haven't seen whatever the critics are saying. I feel like that's going to be a major stumbling block for the film.
Yeah. All right. Now, there's a documentary. Is there not? Hold on. Don't tell me.
We're going to talk about that down the road.
Oh, sorry. Hunters. Let's talk about this. This is Al Pacino.
You're like the announcer is going to hear, now batting cleanup. But wait a minute. We got a leadoff guy here. Yeah, I want to talk to you about Hunters. I think this is because this has been getting a lot of press and a lot of advance hype because it's Al Pacino's first TV series. And we say TV series, it's Amazon Prime, but everybody knows what we mean now. First streaming episodic show that Al Pacino's ever done. Now, I want to preface this by saying I think this is a really cool, it's a 10-part series. It's 1 hour each episode. Actually, mm-hmm. The pilot's an hour and a half. Here's the premise of this. It's 1977, and there's a group mainly based in New York City of Jewish survivors, most of them survivors of the Holocaust, who have discovered that there are many Nazi surviving war criminals who have assimilated into the country, and they're hunting them down. And when they hunt them down, they do not turn them over to the authorities. They bleed them out one way or another. They kill them. And this is done, this whole thing is done in very much a kind of a comic book style. It could be very serious, but it's very much like a Tarantino or Guy Ritchie film. So here's a little sampling of Hunters.
There's evil living here. Bad neighbors.
They blinded themselves to us.
You can get away with anything in America.
So your grandmother and I created the Hunters.
We put together a group of Nazi hunters.
We're a lock picker, a spy, soldier, master of disguise,
Showtime.
And two weapons experts.
We would bring God's justice. What do you say?
I want in.
Al Pacino is Meyer Offerman, the multimillionaire bankroller of the Hunters.
Interesting.
On the heels of his role as Schwartz, the agent is Schwartz in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Right. That's right.
He's branching out.
It's basically the same. It's the same accent he's working right there. Yeah, yeah. Well, now Simon Wiesenthal was a very famous Nazi hunter from that era, from the 1970s,
yeah.
And there was a team of people that were going around the world, mostly South America, but they would go around the world. There was all kinds of Nazis and still remaining in Europe, and there were some here. You might remember there was a guy that was working in Chicago,
right?
That they said was a butcher in the camps, and this is rooted in a real thing. Now,
yes.
In Simon Wiesenthal's world, they weren't killing them,
right?
Necessarily, or handing them over to authorities.
But the creator of the show, the part that is more rooted in real life, or at least inspired, he heard stories from his family, including his grandmother, who was a Holocaust survivor. When this series flashbacks to the concentration camp scenes, because we see all these characters, including Al Pacino's character as a young man, no digitizing, just other actors playing mm-hmm. them, the tone is very, very serious. It's like the level of Schindler's List, depicting some really brutal horrors, and in particular, the sadistic actions of certain camp guards, camp commanders, who are now alive in 1970. So we see the horrors they create, which I think is an important thing, because then when we see them in the 70s and they seem to just be lovable NASA scientists
mm-hmm.
or
right,
toy shop owners or the friendly baker down the street who have a story about how they got out of Germany and they were not a part of the war and they've got new identities. We know the truth about them. So we're rooting for the Hunters. We're rooting for the Hunters every step of the way.
It's interesting. Oh, so you get the back. So you
because you know how evil
there.
They yeah. were. Because when you see them in present day, they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. I've never harmed anyone.
You think about the difference between 1977 and World War II is the difference between 1988 and today.
Yeah. So in other words, these a lot of them would only be in their 50s and 60s in the 70s because they were young men and women. And there's some fascinating stuff, too. And this is all purely fictional. But there's also this is during the Carter administration. And one of his top White House aides, who has a Southern accent, is actually a Nazi. And everybody, he's always like, Billy Carter and I having a good time. But then he gets on the phone in the basement. We are going to get them all. And it's Dylan Baker, who's a great character actor, playing this guy who's actually trying to, you know, infiltrate the highest levels of the government and influence, you know, certain decisions that are being made. So it's 3.5 stars for Hunters. It's fascinating. The first episode is an hour and a half. It's like watching a feature film. Sets the table for everything you're going to see. And yes, you're going to have to wait week by week. You're not getting all
that. I hate that.
Live with it.
Now, have you seen the whole thing?
I've seen the first six.
Okay, so 3.5 stars for the first six. It's probably not going to go down from there. I think it's
ultra violent, and it does have. I mean, there are moments where it looks like an exploitation drive-in film from the 70s. Some of the Nazi hunters are, as I mentioned, Holocaust survivors. Others are like, there's a nun, for example, a British nun.
Wow,
you know. So there's interesting characters, and they're all, each one of them is introduced like through their own movie trailer, done in 70s style. So there's a lot of cool touches like that. And then, you know, when they get it, when the Nazis get it, the camera doesn't cut away.
Al Pacino could not be having a greater renaissance than he's having right now. He's in all these great films. You know, he's in The Irishman. He was spectacular. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, spectacular. He's found a way to find himself, even though in The Irishman, it's very hard. It's kind of a supporting role, but it's also kind of the lead at the same time. But
it's 9 hours long, as people know. They've heard about the running time, so he's in it for about 6 hours.
You know, I wish you would not do that, because people are still upset about that, and they shouldn't, because if they just went and saw it, it's a barrier to entry for people to watch The Irishman. If you just saw it, it would wash across you. You would love it, and it would go by in like an hour and a half.
I think all Netflix should do right now is just at the hour mark of the 3.5 hour movie, at each hour mark, just put that little thing in the lower right corner that says next episode in 9 seconds, skip intro, and people will feel like, oh, that was a great episode. I can't wait to watch the next one. And they'd still be watching the same movie.
Good idea. So
I'm doing that in life now. When people get tired of me, just click for the next episode.
I'm going to adopt that myself. Does Al Pacino's got other stuff? I was just looking at IMDb. He's got other stuff in the pipeline, too.
Yeah, he's really, and you know, he continued to work. He's like certain actors, like, for example, Joe Pesci, who pretty much stepped out of the spotlight. Al Pacino continued to work because he likes to work. He would do stage work. He was in a lot of movies that I think just Al and I saw over the last maybe, like, from about 2011.
The director's mother probably saw it too.
He played a musician, kind of like almost like a James Taylor-esque musician at the end of his career in one movie. There were a bunch of movies where you're like, wait a minute, that's Al Pacino. Tons of wigs, lots of goatees, big glasses. He likes doing all that. But he's getting more Al Pacino-esque material, which is great to see.
Right. And he was always trying to do some sort of an accent. You're like, I don't know what the hell that is.
Oh, yeah, a lot of times.
That you're doing. Like, I don't know. It was just roaring. Although, I got to tell you, I love him in the Ocean's movies. You know, as the casino owner.
That was Andy Garcia.
That's what I meant.
Wait a minute, you had me for a second there. I'm very confused now.
Wait, hold on, I gotta look that up. Wasn't he? Yeah, no, he was in. Oh, let me look. Hold on, I got this figured out. I've had a rough day. Let us now check in with James Sears. He's got the news at the bottom of the hour, and then back with Richard. Rokan Show right here on 720 WGN. Richard Roper is here. We are reviewing some films. He is reviewing some films. I'm just sitting here making mistakes. I do want to make it clear. We were talking about Al Pacino because he's in this Hunters, which is on Amazon Prime. If you have Amazon Prime, it starts Sunday, I believe. They're going to drop one a week. They're Nazi hunters. You say it's 3.5 stars for this 10-part series.
Yes.
And I said, you know, Al Pacino, we're talking about Al Pacino's career, and having this amazing resurgence. And I had said I loved him in that Ocean's movie. It was Ocean's 13.
Yeah, you were right. It was like the debate in Nevada. We were both right on certain points there, because he wasn't in the first two or the next two or the four before that or the ones. But he wasn't. You were absolutely right. He was the new target, you know, that they went after in Ocean's 13. Alan Barkin was in that one, too.
That's right. And
we did Sea of Love a long time ago. A good film.
Exactly. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I think Elizabeth Warren was in that film as well.
How about that?
All right. Now, you said that's 3.5 stars for the Hunters.
Yeah.
The Call of the Wild, if you just missed this, Harrison Ford, that film you say is 2 stars.
Yes.
unfortunately, because of the
Call of the Wild,
cartoony way the dog looks.
Yeah, and there's a nifty thriller called The Lodge that I like with Riley Keough, who is the granddaughter of Elvis Presley. So you can check that out if you like those scary movies where the family goes to the remote cabin in the woods.
Oh yeah, sure.
And then Dad drives off because he has to go to work, leaving. And Dad always leaves these horror movies. You know, everybody always criticizes the moms for making bad decisions because they go down into the attic or up to the attic or down in the cellar with the flashlight when they hear, you know, they hear the creaky noises.
They go
toward it. And the dog is always, talking about the Call of the Wild, the dog is always the first to tell you that something's going on because the dog can hear everything. But the dad takes off. But the movie's called The Lodge. Check it out. But I also wanted to talk about an ESPN documentary that's debuting this Sunday, and that is on ESPN, as you might expect, on the television. But it's really a film. It's, you know, in that whole 30 for 30 umbrella they have. And this one is called D-Wade, Life Unexpected. And it is indeed the life story of Dwayne Wade, the proprietor of Richards High School, the Marquette Warriors, and, of course, the Miami Heat, and even a little bit of time with the Chicago Bulls. It's really fascinating because when you think about it, he's only 38 years old. It feels like we've known about Dwayne Wade forever because
of here.
Here in Chicago, because he was a huge star at Richards. I mean, he's one of the best players in the country.
22 years we've been thinking about him.
Exactly. And what's, I think, fascinating about this, Roe, is he's had a film crew with him for most of the last 10 years. But, of course, there's a lot of footage from before that because there always is when a player has that kind of stature. So it's really fascinating because his mother and father, who he's now reconciled with, but when he was growing up, he actually grew up 58th and Prairie, Washington Park. He played for Richards High School, but that's where he was as a kid. And his father was an Army veteran who came out and had a huge drinking problem and was on and off with his mother. His mother was a heroin addict who wasn't in his life at all, which is why to this day you always hear about him and his sister, his big sister, and how close they are. So it's really fascinating to hear even his parents talk about how tough his life was growing up. So this is the clip where Dwayne Wade Sr. talks about his son.
I made this basketball court on top of the garage so that they wouldn't have to leave the yard to play, so everybody in the neighborhood could come. Now, I had them playing against grown-ups, you know what I'm saying? That's what toughened them up. We knock them down, beat them up. They cry, they can't leave the court. If you cry, you can't eat. You know what I'm saying? Stuff like that. Real tough, man.
My dad played with us, and he wouldn't give us an inch, man. Like, he played against us like we was grown-ass men. You know what I'm saying? And like, and it went from crying to fear to, wait a minute, like, this is just how it is, and this is how it has to be.
Fascinating.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And as Dwayne says later on in the film, you know, all the adversity that, you know, whether it's personal life stuff or different basketball struggles, he says nothing compared to what he went through growing up. His mother actually at one point says, you know, at least I shielded my son from like the worst parts of my life. And he's like, Ma, you didn't. I watched you shoot up. You were just so out of it, you didn't realize it. And he goes, after you've been through that, everything else you go through is nowhere near as challenging. And then the film does follow him all the way through. I mean, you think about the fact he led Marquette to the Final Four when it was at the time a dormant program, came out of nowhere. Fifth overall pick by the Miami Heat, Pat Riley in the Miami Heat. And then people might forget this. Everybody remembers the LeBron, Chris Bosh, Dwayne Wade championship teams, but they actually won their first championship because Shaq came to the Heat for a brief period of time. So in Miami, as much as they appreciated LeBron coming, Dwayne Wade is the face of the Miami Heat franchise. They call that, you know, Wade County instead of like Dade County because you know, he owns it and they love him to this day. So it gets into all that stuff as well.
He there's also stuff about his family currently.
Yes.
He's got kids. He has one kid with with the woman here in Chicago.
He had two sons with his childhood sweetheart, and that people will remember the custody case that was very bitter, high profile. He wanted to get custody of the two children. She went through 13 lawyers. We actually talked to her at one point, you and I, in a different iteration of this show. Very troubled. He ended up getting the full custody, but got dragged out for more than 2 years because she'd switch lawyers, and then they'd start all over again. And during all that time, he couldn't get to see the children.
Right.
So
yeah,
he was
a very ugly situation here.
Eventually, ended up with custody of those two boys. Then, you know, to this day, he's with Gabrielle Union. Bring it on. You know, you see them doing the commercials and everything. And as much as that is the storybook romance and has portrayed that as such, there was a moment where they are on a break and he fathered a child with a different woman, and they get into that here. And then as people have seen, there's been a lot of publicity and press about Zaya, his 12-year-old, who has told her parents, who told Dwayne and now Gabrielle and everybody else in the family, that she's a she, born as a boy, but identifies as female,
right,
and wants to transgender.
And that is a fascinating thing, because Dwayne Wade is such a high-profile athlete. Is, you know, he comes from a world, and that athletic world, and yeah, he comes from a street world, where that is a completely anathema code.
Yeah.
Now, not that it's not seen or understood or even empathized with, but it in terms of that code, it's not respected. And this is an opportunity for Dwayne Wade to make a really huge cultural difference here.
Yeah, and he talks about that. He says, growing up, if somebody was gay, we never knew it. Certainly if somebody was transitioning or transgender or wanted to, we never knew it. And he talks about it. He goes, I have to educate myself. He also has, there's private conversations he had with Zaya, and he asked her if it was okay to include them in the film, where it's just the two of them.
Wow.
At one point, just sitting in a car or a golf cart and really talking about it, and got her permission, and they're in the film, and it's you know, pretty, as the film says, a life unexpected. It's a really, really strong documentary. I'm giving it 3 stars.
If ESPN.
You're a fan of, yeah, if you're a fan of basketball. And one last thing I'll say about this, it's really interesting. The famous decision. Everybody says that Chris Bosh, LeBron James, and D-Wade had figured that all out in advance. But LeBron had ghosted D-Wade 3 days before that, so he had to watch the decision on TV just like everybody else. And he actually has video of his viewing party at home waiting to hear where LeBron was going to go.
Pretty amazing. Cool.
Yeah.
D-Wade, Life Unexpected on ESPN this Sunday as well. Big Sunday night for the televised
a lot of good stuff out there.
Stuff. Yeah. All right, stay right here, Richard Roper, because there's changes coming to the NFL. We'll get your thoughts on that as a gambling expert as well. But first, here's Lauren Lapka. She's got the traffic and the weather.